Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tinsberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. Well, today I have three writers. They have put together a book called Buffalo Trace, A Threefold Vibration. They, all three of them, went to the same graduate school in English at what was called the State University of New York at Buffalo. What is it called now?
University at Buffalo.
No more SUNY. No more SUNY. And lo and behold, not only did the three of them go to graduate school at the State University of New York at Buffalo, I was an undergraduate at that blessed place. And you see, the marvelous thing is that Buffalo seems to have been the happy recipient of something called the miracle years. Why? Can you tell the story, James Morrison, also known as Jim Morrison?
Well, for decades, in fact, over a century, the University of Buffalo was a private institution. But in the early 1960s, it became a state university under the auspices of Rockefeller. Apparently, there was money then for higher education, a circumstance that we have not encountered in recent decades. And in fact, there was a lot of money. So Rockefeller hired a man named Al Cook to put together the best English department he possibly could. And he gave Cook carte blanche. And Cook had the inspired idea. Of course, literary study was not professionalized in the 60s in the way that it has become in the decades since. But Cook's inspired idea was to hire brilliant people, perhaps his own conception of brilliant people, but people who were essentially writers first and scholars second, if at all.
These are people who were at Buffalo when, under the new auspices of the gold rush, these people were teaching all at the same time at Buffalo.
John Barth, Donald Barthelme, Charles Olson.
René Girard.
Yes.
And I don't know if Ray Fetterman was there yet, but could be.
He would be, yes.
Mm-hmm. And maybe Norman Holland.
Norman Holland.
Maybe. Leslie Fiedler, Robert Creeley, Rodolphe Gachet.
Dwight MacDonald, the man who would eventually become the Poet Laureate of America. Robert Haas, who at that time, he was just a teacher of Victorian literature. He was so nonplussed by the number of great poets around him that he didn't show his work. It wasn't until he left Buffalo that he started to publish poetry. Do you know who we're leaving out? John Coetzee, or as some people say, Coetzee, a Nobel Prize winner, who, when he started at Buffalo, had one book published in South Africa. It had never appeared in America. There was, I will say it straightforwardly, no better place to be excited by the study of literature than at Buffalo. It was something like a dream come true. I went to this place having promised my parents that I would be a math major, but the English department was so stunning. Way back then, the late 60s, they wanted to see if there could be a course in the literature of comic books, what we're calling graphic novels now. The idea that you could go off to a school and learn to be a bohemian, to learn to be a person of sensibility, to learn to look at difficult movies and know how to see them and understand what they were saying, to be a part of what was considered to be sometimes the new culture or the counterculture. Yeah. You could go to school at Buffalo not just learning literature, but learning the humanities. That is to say, learning what puts the human in the human being.
Yes, you're making me think that even if we didn't take the major hits approach to what made Buffalo great, as in terms of all of the luminaries who were there, and isn't this surprising and astonishing that they were at the State University, I think we could turn to the ways in which teaching happened there and the quality of thought and the way of thinking that was we were asked and encouraged to cultivate, which in large part was not about sequestering, as so often is the case in academe, the critical from the creative. I mean, it's one of many things that I think we can talk about that distinguished Buffalo as a place where an atmospherics of the weird, the odd, the not entirely arcane, but hopefully always original, thought was being cultivated.
So what these three did, Mary Capello, say it so they can hear your voice.
Mary Capello.
James Morrison, who did not start a famous rock band.
Not without trying, James Morrison.
And Gene Walton.
Gene Walton.
That way perhaps you can start to recognize their voices. They've each written an essay about coming to the idea that the life of the mind was a way of life. In this book called Buffalo Trace, A Threefold Variation. Why three? There are three writers. There are three major sections of the book. It's published by an independent press called Spuyten Duyvil, and it was there in graduate school that young people discovered how to feel, and they discovered, get this, works of literature as being perfect tutors, and teachers who were older than they as being tutors as well. It's exactly what Plato was talking about when he is telling a young man that the learning of how to write is developed from the learning of how to speak. That living becomes speaking, that speaking becomes writing, that writing becomes culture. So
I always said that I learned how to write by listening to James Morrison speak.
So. How wonderful. James, did you know that?
I've heard it. but, you know, Michael, the Buffalo that we all encountered was quite different from the one that you did. You were there at the height of the counterculture, and when it was magic. At the height of its own legend, it remained an enchanted place when we were there in the 1980s. But one of the things the book is about is not just the sort of struggle to enter something like the life of the mind against all odds in our culture, but at a time when there was a certain sense of the fall from grace. It was still a magical place, an enchanted place, but it was, after all, in Buffalo. Buffalo is, of course, by almost any estimation, a location that perhaps even thinks of itself as marginal.
And yet, somehow or other, these mansions that were once built when it was, after all, a port city on the Erie Canal, all these mansions were built. There was no one to live in them. There was no money to heat them. And graduate students and even undergraduate students like me could be living in these astonishing three-story posh houses.
Yes, so even in your day, the sense of Buffalo as having a kind of residual quality, in other words, the place that used to be a boomtown, this extraordinary American location where you could still see the traces of that former glory in just about every recess of it.
The book inadvertently, I think, ends up, among many of its threads in common, addressing failure as a form of beauty. And I think that's partly
true.
Because it is inflected by the place where we were studying and learning and coming into ourselves. And I thought of Buffalo as the premier place to develop a poetic sensibility, in part because of those interiors, Michael, of which you speak. It always struck me that here we have some of the harshest weather on the planet, and that's what Buffalo is known for. And these people built these wonderful interiors as a buffer against the outdoors, and therefore a place to explore interiority.
Understand, at that time, it wasn't yet an academic malfeasance. If you had a professor you loved and you wanted to spend all your time with him or her, no one regarded that as a suspicious desire. Sometimes it was very suspicious, and there were people that people knew about who were sleeping with their professors. Yes, we knew it was evil. We knew it was bad. We knew we couldn't tell the adults about it, and yet it wasn't something that we wanted to stop. Now, it's very hard to make a case for that. I acknowledge it. It's very difficult. Many of these students were being taken advantage of by their older and should know better professors. But I'm not mentioning that Michel Foucault was teaching there for the first time in America. He was teaching at Buffalo, not at Yale, not at Johns Hopkins. He was teaching at Buffalo. And what did he do? He wrote The History of Sexuality. Who could you learn these things from better? I can't tell you the things that Michel taught me because the words can't be used on radio.
Well, I would only say once again that you were there at a somewhat different time. And my own experience was that of a hotbed of intellectual activity that was also marked by a certain kind of cultivated indifference on the part of the professors. In other words, they thought that you were supposed to be learning on your own, and they were there to perhaps usher you into some of the secrets, but you were supposed to be learning it. They weren't necessarily supposed to be teaching you. You know,
well, I think a great case in point is a seminar that Jim and I were in together that was orchestrated by Irving Massey. And I recall that I think the class was ostensibly a class in the history of critical theory. The way that that class was structured was that there were many books that we were asked to read and expected to read, but we never discussed those books in the seminar. The seminar was about being present to Irving as he worked on his then idea that he was developing across the course of those several months, which had to do with the nature of metaphor. And the understanding was that we would be reading all of the books that he was suggesting we read in order to be able to be present to the thinking that he was doing, and from there develop, obviously, our own thoughts.
Yeah, it was a theoretical hotbed, I would say, and it wasn't only one genre of theory. It wasn't only deconstruction.
It was also psychoanalysis.
It had the Center for the Psychoanalytic Study of the Arts. That was one of the things that drew me, and I think Mary as well. But it wasn't the only thing that I paid attention to while I was there. And I think that by the second or third year, I began to feel pulled in at least two directions in terms of the conflict.
My guest, Jean Walton, was discovering that while she was there, she tells us in her essay, she was trying to be as many different types of sexual person that she could discover herself able to be.
Absolutely.
And in the course of it, like my other two guests, she discovered that she was coming out as queer.
Mm-hmm.
And that
it wasn't a simple, oh, I've been being straight all along and now I'm coming out of my closet into the world of queerness. It was more like, the way I put it was that I had to go through a very long training period with lots of different people.
You tell in your essay, which is the second essay of the book, the first essay is Jim's essay, which I feel has its feet on the ground. The second essay is Jean's essay, where she is beginning to retreat into a dialogue with herself and with her mentors to see who she is and who she may be. And imagine reading this essay about a graduate student who discovers, after having an affair with one of her professors, that she is in fact in love with one of her fellow students, a woman, and that they know love as soon as they encounter it. In fact, they know it so well that how many years later?
We don't usually count.
Give me
but
a
it's
coup.
Something it's like over, 35.
Yeah, it's like 35
years later, mm-hmm. This intimation that they had fallen in love holds true to this day.
I think Mary knew she had fallen in love. I was skeptical for a long time.
Well, you
I
were much
asking,
more
what is
practical.
Love? What is love?
Yes. Mary was a poet, you mm-hmm. see, and you were trying to see whether the psychoanalytic approach to literature could solve the problems of literature, implicitly of life. So you wanted much more. Mary, whose essay is the last in the book, and I would say if this book has been designed, and it has, to take you from the ground of who we are, where we are, what we are, to who we might be, who am I? Can you tell me who I am? Can I tell me who I am? But this book is a history of the education of the spirit by three writers who on different planes participated in that education. The book is called Buffalo Trace, A Threefold Vibration. My authors are Mary Capello, James Morrison, Gene Walton. The publisher is Spuyten Duyvil. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Mary Capello, James Morrison, and Gene Walton about their book, Buffalo Trace, A Threefold Vibration, a trio of novella-length autobiographical essays about the minds and bodies of people in a place and time who are trying to discover within themselves the virtue of the culture of literature, film, art, music, dance, all being exposed to them at a certain place, the State University of New York at Buffalo graduate program in English. One of them, Mary, already knows that she wants to be a poet. Jean is studying the intersection between literature and psychoanalysis. James Morrison meets Mary in the off-campus housing office their first year there. Mary thinks, well, he's not exactly a flaming queen, but there's no way he's straight. And then says, well, wait, there's no way I'm straight either. And the beginning of the dropping of judgment begins then and there. And everyone is reading the books that are enjoining you to stop judging and learn a new way of thinking about life. Tell me, now each of you is teaching at a university. Did the lessons you learned at Buffalo make you a better teacher? Are you able to talk to the students in the permissive language, the opening, the language of opening doors that you learned at a place like Buffalo?
Most definitely, I hope so. One of the things that I bring to my classes, and especially when I'm teaching creative writing, that is Buffalo influenced, absolutely, is the idea that you don't come into a writing workshop with the hope of going out with a toolbox or a bag of tricks. That what I'm trying to help students to discover in and for themselves is the necessity of cultivating a sensibility. And so there's that. There's also this sense of asystematicity that I learned at Buffalo that is really wonderful for some students and really threatening and difficult for others. And it has to do with a willingness to say that we don't know where we're going each class. We don't even know, even though I'm required to put the syllabus together, where we might arrive.
I totally agree with that. And I would say that in some ways, in recent years, we've run into some trouble doing this because the Buffalo way of learning is not coincident with an emphasis now on being able to mark and measure what our student outcomes are. That is to say, first of all, laying out what is it you want your students to learn? Show us the tool that you are using to measure this, and then show us exactly how you've measured it and whether you have delivered it to them. This is completely inimical to anything we learned at Buffalo and that we value from Buffalo. That is to say, every course is itself an organically developing entity from beginning to end, and it has to do with a relationship that develops between us and our students over a period of time. The only thing that is set, really, are the readings, and even that isn't entirely set because, just as happened in Buffalo, sometimes some readings will drop out and others will come in as the conversations draw us.
A particular kind of student was drawn to graduate study at Buffalo. In our era, the memory of its counterculture heyday was still strong, and part of what signified that was that the program had almost no restrictions. In other words, at the level of graduate study, you entered that program and they said, go take 10 seminars and then come back when you're done and you'll do an orals exam and then write a PhD dissertation. Other programs that were rigidly structured around period, author, genre, etc. But at Buffalo, it was really, go take 10 seminars and then check back. And you're not going to get grades. If you don't do well, you will be told that you didn't do well, but you're not getting an A or a B or a C. You're going to just get a sort of a written evaluation at the end. So, you know, that unstructured quality was part of what made it such a vital place. And as money gets siphoned off of higher education, administration gets ladled onto it. And that's where we are today. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the reasons that we wanted to write about the experience of going to this very special place at one of the last times when there really was a kind of vital higher education in the United States before the support for it was withdrawn.
As I read Buffalo Trace, a threefold vibration, I found myself off and on again crying, and not so much crying, but weeping, you know, the uncontrolled thing. I'm a weeper, I confess. But it was in particular to be reminded of a kind of person. For James Morrison and I, that person is represented by a brilliant man named Irving Massey, who brought to his teaching and to his thinking a quality of heartbrokenness and melancholy that was so impressive. It was not the professionalism of literary theory and all of its strategies. No, it was written out of, he writes a lot about nonsense, the need for language to escape its solemn responsibilities and to return to something like, if not beauty, at least nonsense, at least to be freed of making too much sense. I discovered that Irving has written a new book on nonsense. I'm reading it, and it's better than thought. It stops thought. It sends thought on vacation. You are allowed to stop thinking while you're put in the suspension of possibility that perhaps all this language is not helping you, and that what you need is language that doesn't define. I read Buffalo Trace, A Threefold Vibration, in a state of kind of ecstasy. You can get this book from Spite and Devil, its publisher. You can go on web to wherever you order your books from. All I can say is that if you are a person of mind, of sensibility, and letters, you will be reminded of something that was once infinitely precious and that could be precious again. And thank you, all three of you, very much for joining me. I've been talking with Mary Capello, James Morrison, and Jean Walton, authors of Buffalo Trace, A Threefold Vibration. They each graduated as graduate students from the State University of New York at Buffalo. They each of them teach literature, film, creative writing in American universities. The book is published by Spite and Devil. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so
it's
much,
it's been
Michael.
Really a pleasure to me. You've brought back something that I was missing. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. Technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Joshua Cohen is our guest.